The Nets and Lakers meet tonight in a showdown that features the second-place team in the East versus the second-place team in the West. According to ESPN's Basketball Power Index, a Lakers-Nets final is the third most likely matchup. Interesting. Marinate on that for a second. You can see him right there at 12.5%. So, Stephen A., barring any major injuries, do you feel like the Nets and Lakers are a lock to meet in the finals?
Yes, I do. If Anthony Davis were 100%, I think the Los Angeles Lakers are going to the finals. If the Brooklyn Nets are 100%, there's nobody in the East that's beating them. I've stated that from day one, and I maintain that position that the Brooklyn Nets and the Los Angeles Lakers will meet for the NBA championship come July. My attitude is very, very simple. I think that when you look at AD and you look at LeBron James, as great as the Utah Jazz are looking right now, as much of a threat as the Denver Nuggets could end up being, Portland could end up being, etc., I think LeBron and his brilliance combined with the greatness of Anthony Davis and the way Frank Vogel and his staff have those guys playing defense, they get themselves ready for playoff competitions. And it's all about matchups. And nobody is better at exploiting matchups than LeBron James. All right. So that's what I think about with the Lakers, plain and simple. When I think about the Brooklyn Nets, I think that Kyrie, James Harden and Kevin Durant are just lethal. They are absolutely sensational offensively. And I think in this particular case, a great offense makes for a better defense. I don't think that they're going to be the elite defense by any stretch of the imagination. Max has highlighted how awful they have been. Nevertheless, we found ourselves looking at them and we said, you know what? They're getting a little better defensively, particularly at key moments in fourth quarters. I've seen them do it. And then you look at how lethal they can be offensively, not just from the perimeter, not just scoring overall, but what they do from the free throw line. They don't miss free throws either. And I think that's pivotal. And I think when you look at the Philadelphia 76ers, Ben Simmons, as great as he is, he doesn't even attempt perimeter shots. I don't think that you can beat them without him doing that, even though they have Seth Curry and Tobias Harris. I look at Boston, I question their depth, and I don't know what's going on with Kemba Walker. And I look at, Miami, they're sliding fast. They're not what they used to be. The Milwaukee Bucks, they've been struggling. And if Giannis can't make perimeter shots, as I've said on many occasions, you don't have a prayer in hell against the Brooklyn Nets and specifically Kevin Durant. So I look at the Brooklyn Nets, and I don't see anything standing in their way but themselves, and I don't think they will do that. The Brooklyn Nets, if healthy, the Brooklyn Nets and the Los Angeles Lakers will meet for the NBA championship in July, and I don't have a scintilla of doubt about it.
That's possible, but I think there's plenty of doubt. Number one, the Western Conference. Let's not pretend this is the same old Jazz. This is something different. Mike Conley was not Mike Conley last year. He is this year. He's one of the best players in the league. And when you combine him with Donovan Mitchell, and like just consider that the Jazz gave the Nuggets, it's one of the all-time great seven-game series in the first round, gave him everything they wanted without Bogdanovich. Now add him and also add the real Mike Conley. They're being compared to the Spurs from several years ago. And those teams beat everyone. They beat LeBron James teams. They beat everyone. They beat the Lakers. And for good reason, they're being compared to them. And then the Clippers. The Clippers have gotten better when healthy. Not only does Paul George have a lot to make up for now, but they have Ibaka and, as I mentioned, Nick Batum, who's back to playing kind of like he played when he got that max deal or close to it in the first place. And that's just in the Western Conference, and I haven't even mentioned Denver or if Dallas can get it all together, right? It's choppy waters in the Western Conference. But what about the Eastern Conference? You know, I agree with you about the Bucks, Stephen A. I'm not convinced about the Bucks, but the Sixers are another story, and I will tell you why. You mentioned Ben Simmons can't shoot the three. If he could, I'd be just taking the Sixers already. Because the difference between the Sixers and the Nets, no team in the last 20 years has won a championship ranked lower than 11th defensively. James Harden is right when he says, guys, we don't have to be awesome defensively, just average. If we're just average defensively, but Stephen A., they're not. They're dead last. Like, they're awful defensively. Sixers aren't. Matter of fact, and when you talk about Ben Simmons' three-point shooting, Stephen A., on the court, when Ben Simmons is on the court, they shoot 41% from three. It's the second best in the league. When he's off the court, they shoot 29% from the three. At least this was true a week ago. 29% is dead last. So while Simmons himself doesn't shoot, he makes everybody else much better. They go from worst, basically, to basically best with Simmons on the floor. So you know what the difference is here with the Sixers? This is not your slightly older sibling 76ers. They have Daryl Morey now. And obviously Doc Rivers. But what Maury did in Houston is the same thing he's doing here. He's like, we are going to play the most efficient brand of basketball. He just didn't have the horses in Houston. Not really. He has the horses in Philadelphia. Embiid's playing at MVP level. He'd be my pick for MVP right now. Mm-hmm. And Ben Simmons is also excellent. And they got shooters everywhere you look. The Nets can get there, but they must start playing defense.
Let me educate you about something here, Max. And I say that respectfully. When you're watching the game of basketball, let me give you a little bit of insight into my philosophy about certain things. When you spend years not showing up when it counts, and what I mean by that is I'm not talking about choking or anything like that. I'm just talking about you just don't have it. You're not that person. You see what I'm saying? You're a role player. You're a marginal player. I'm not talking about a James Harden who's been a little less than what we're accustomed to seeing him be in a regular season once the postseason arrives, because I believe in James Harden, and I believe that James Harden is going to show up in some capacity and have some kind of a positive impact. I'm talking about the guys that just don't necessarily have it. It's not who they are. There are limits. There's a ceiling. I don't rely on those folks when it comes time. See, when you see it during the regular season, that's nice. But when it gets tight and when the competition gets elite, and that pressure mounts, I'm not sold on you if I've never seen you there before. That's just not me. And so when I think about the Philadelphia 76ers, I like Tobias Harris a lot. I believe in Seth Curry. I love Joel Embiid and what he brings to the table. And I believe in Ben Simmons to a point. Do I believe they can get to the conference finals? Hell yeah. Do I believe they can win it all going up against an offensive juggernaut like the Brooklyn Nets? That's where my reservations kick in. Milwaukee, Giannis, you ain't never work on your J. I don't believe all of a sudden you're going to find it come postseason time. When I think about Boston, I believe in Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown a lot. I don't believe in their depth, all right? I'm not sold on it, and I believe that ultimately it'll be too much for them to overcome. That's what I'm talking about here. They're going to be relevant. They're going to be in the picture. I believe in Utah with Donovan Mitchell. He's a stud. Rudy Gobert and Bogdanovich and all of these guys can play that role.
Keep
but
going.
When the pressure mounts, when it mounts, can I rely on you to take me there? And I'm not there.
This is a good point. I agree with the philosophy. If you ask me, who would I think is going to get to the finals? I do think it'll be Lakers-Nets. I think the Nets problems are fixable, but that doesn't mean it's a guarantee they fix them. So what you're talking about with the Sixers, I get it. Or with teams like that, I get it. The Sixers have to, Embiid and Simmons have to show. Embiid can physically hold up and Simmons can show up, whether he's in a dunker spot or anywhere. But that doesn't mean they can't. And in the Western Conference, here's the thing about Utah. Stephen A., I've seen enough about from Donovan Mitchell. He'll be there. When
He'll
it matters
there.
Most, Donovan Mitchell will be there. And that is a really good team. That makes them dangerous. So I can't just write them off. I can't just write the Sixers off.
I'm not right. Well, I could tell you this. I watched the Sixers against Portland last week, and there was a play where Carmelo Anthony was sticking Ben Simmons right near half court and was trying to be up on him. And then he said, what the hell am I thinking? And then back 15 feet away. What am I doing guarding him for? That's what I'm talking about. These are the kind of things. Come playoff time, you ain't got to worry about that. Got to be able to put the ball in the hole from the perimeter.
I mean, raise your hand if you would go for a coast-to-coast finals. Hey, Molly Karam here, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. When you're on a business trip, you know what goes completely off the rails? Your workout routine. Especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups, sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or you just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up, power your buys, your tries the right way, or de-stress with a little cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Brought to you by the Capital One Venture X Card. Earn unlimited 2X miles in everything you buy and turn everyday purchases into extraordinary trips. Plus, receive premium travel benefits, like access to over 1,300 airport lounges and a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. Unlock a whole new world of travel with a Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
All right, gentlemen, according to our Adrian Wojnarowski, many NBA players are expressing apprehension about participating in a league-sponsored public service announcement to bolster broader acceptance of the coronavirus vaccine. Player apprehensions about receiving the vaccine are consistent with those that also exist in black communities throughout the country. Agents and players told ESPN, here's Meta Sandiford Artest on the Freddie and Fitzsimmons show.
I think everybody have a human right to do what they want. And sometimes you have your human rights, and sometimes people will look down on you for basic human rights. And this has been happening for a long time. So if you want to promote a vaccine, then do it. If you don't want to promote it, then don't. Right? It's solely up to the individual human being.
All right. Obviously, Meta Sandiford Artest is Ron Artest, in case anybody was concerned, formerly Ron Artest. Stephen A., this is a serious issue. There's a lot of layers to it, and it goes back to our country's history. What's your reaction to the news?
Well, it's very understandable. Let me be very, very serious when I say that there's obviously a severe mistrust of the federal government, and you consider the times that we're living in, particularly feeding off of the racial injustice issues that have really percolated and come to the forefront over the last year. Certainly, this is like the worst time in the world to ask black Americans in this nation to trust the federal government. Having said all of that, I think that considering the times that we're living in and how pertinent this issue is and how many lives have been lost and attached to the coronavirus pandemic, I do think that it would be irresponsible for me or anybody else to definitively say that we shouldn't trust anybody at a time like this. Because remember that this is a situation as it pertains to COVID-19 that doesn't just involve you and the harm that can come to you, but the harm you could do to other people without even knowing it. And so when you think about the lives that could potentially be affected just because you're around somebody, you're breathing in their direction, you're doing other different things, you're touching surfaces, you're touching your own face, all of this other stuff, I do think that I have reached a point in time where enough folks have taken the vaccine. I was very, very hesitant at the beginning. But if I'm asked to do it at some point in time, I'm definitely going to do it, whether it's Moderna or Pfizer or something else. It'll probably be one of those two when my opportunity comes and it's presented to me to take the vaccine. In all likelihood, I will elect to do that. Having said all of that, I want to make a very, very big important point, Max, as it pertains to the NBA and the other professional sports leagues about this. The time has come to stop worrying about PR and as it pertains to jumping to the head of the line or whatever the case may be. Obviously, first responders, teachers, essential workers, they should be at the forefront. They should be first in line to get the vaccines, and I totally get that. But I think when people look at the sports leagues, as you've heard me articulate on several occasions about this issue, Max, too many people, when they think about sports leagues getting the vaccine, they're too busy thinking about the athletes. No, I'm talking about the thousands upon thousands of people who remain gainfully employed because of the leagues. It's important for these sports leagues. First of all, sports does make a contribution, a huge contribution to our society. But secondly, and equally as important, I think it's essential to recognize the fact that if they're playing and they're participating and they're in action, then it allows those leagues to employ the hundreds of thousands of people that are employed. And as a result, you don't have folks incapable of paying their bills. They're not gainfully employed and things of that nature. You make sure you address those issues. It's not about the athletes. It's about what having the sports take place, what it does for our local economy, what it does for our society, and therefore. So that's just my mentality about it. That's how I feel about it. I don't blame the players for being hesitant to promote vaccines, considering our nation's history and our mistrust of the federal government. We know that history. We don't have time to get into it. But I think considering the number of people who have been vaccinated, which are obviously in the millions, and the fact that it's indiscriminate, there are black and whites and others that have taken the vaccine, I do think it's time for all of us to adopt a mentality that if we have the opportunity to do it, it's something that we should do. And if they come my way with it, I will take the vaccine.
Let me address what you just said quickly. Sure. I think as Americans, we are used to a situation where money and power gives you greater access to things, and people feel that that's normal. I think if I were running a league and I could get my hands on vaccines and I could legally distribute it, I would to the players. If you're asking me as an independent arbiter, do I think that that's ethical or moral? The answer is no, I don't. So I disagree with you on principle, but in practice, we probably see, I think there is a case to be made on economic lines along the ones you're making. I think the best way to do it is what the most effective way we've seen internationally is you start with the oldest people, because they're even more with underlying conditions, the oldest, you know, 85 and over, 75 and over, 65 and over, do it like that, and people with underlying conditions and first responders, and then the rest of us wait for it. But okay, it's a separate issue. I want to address what Ron Artest, Meta World Peace, you know, Ron, whoever Artest now, he's one of my favorite people in the industry. He's such a genuine dude, and I actually think here he makes a good point. Athletes should not be forced into positions where they must publicly espouse that they are affirmatively, you know, they're putting their weight behind, yes, everyone should do this, because if they don't feel that way, then they shouldn't be forced into a hypocritical position. This is, however, if the vaccine is available and they opt not to take it, they shouldn't play. Like, that's all, if they don't, but a public service announcement is something else. They should not be forced to do public service announcements, even if I think it's foolish not to. Now, let me tell you why I think it's foolish not to and what I think their problem is. In the Venn diagram, right, you have the different circles and where they overlap is the shaded area. This is a perfect storm, another metaphor for it, of this vaccination issue. Number one, they're pro athletes. Pro athletes care about what they put in their body. And anyone here is, wait, I'm putting a dead disease in my body. Even the thought of it's disturbing to a lot of people, to me. But, you know, even if you understand the science very well, you still say, ugh, I just don't like the idea of it. And pro athletes want to be sure about what they're ingesting. And unless it's going to help them on the field of play especially. That's one. Two, there's a lot of anti-vaxxer nonsense out there. Just nonsense and low-quality information that many among us have swallowed and kind of internalized and now believe. The anti-vaxxer industry is utter nonsense. Nonsense. That's all. It's nonsense. However, there's an overlap there, too, because many in the population, including in the NBA, have subscribed to it, as many people have subscribed to a lot of low-quality information in recent years and misinformation. And three, you mentioned it, Stephen A., the United States has a bad history with African-American people, don't they? And including experiments on African-American people, right? And so if you are, yes, so if you're thinking, wait, I'm not going to be, you want me to take that? Are we sure about this? Are you experimenting on me? I think all three things come into play here. All three things. They want to know what they're putting in their body. They mistrust this country based on past experience, and there's a lot of anti-vaxxer nonsense. It's creating a perfect storm. That said, Stephen A., none of that's a good enough excuse not to take the vaccine if it's available. I think if it's available and an athlete turns it down, they shouldn't play. That's different than saying you have to give a PSA, a public service announcement, saying that you are for this even if you're against it. Two separate issues to me.
I certainly don't believe they should be forced to do a PSA. I totally agree with you there. What I will say, however, is that the athletes themselves have put themselves in a position where people feel they should be compelled to do such a thing by virtue of the reach that they have and how they flaunt that reach and the impact that it has. Like, for example, if you want to sit up there and address, and I know that it's apples and oranges in a lot of people's eyes, but not to me. When you sit up there and you want to address racial injustice issues, and you're talking about it's not just about myself, it's about my family, it's about my community, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in a completely different kind of way, so is the coronavirus pandemic. Because the fact of the matter is that when you get ill, chances are you can make someone else ill. Chances are it's going to be a member of your family, a loved one, et cetera, et cetera. And that reality, being as pertinent as it is, does elevate the level of responsibility if you say, on under any circumstances that something is not about you. It's about the impact that you know you have, the voice that you know you have, the fact that you can give a voice to the voiceless, et cetera, et cetera. And that was impetus enough or motivation enough for you to take certain positions and to put yourself on Front Street. Then someone in the medical profession can simply come to you and say, okay, we've got over 400,000 deaths nationwide. We've got millions upon millions who have died from this worldwide. It's contagious. And there's a vaccine that is proven thus far that it can help derail that issue. Do you not feel an obligation to do that? They can ask the question. And if you don't agree with them, okay, then you do have an obligation to articulate why you don't. Not just be silent and disappear. In other words, just like you gave a voice to everything else, you can give a voice to that too. Even if you're following Max Kellerman's suggestion, you shouldn't be mandated to do it. Just like you were willing to come out and speak intelligently and passionately about what you felt about other things that you felt affected the largest segments of our populace, of our society, well, so does this. And as a result, make sure you don't hide. Don't just disappear. Don't just be quiet. Don't just go away. If you were speaking out before, it's relevant to speak out about it now. Why you think I spoke about it this morning? Because we were on the air talking about our hesitancy with COVID-19, the need for vaccinations and stuff like that. But once it happens, would you be willing to do it, Stephen A? Would you be willing to do it, Max and Molly? We talked about this. So now that it's an issue, we don't get to hide and be quiet. We got to be front and center with our positions about that now, too, just like we are about everything else. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. I'll just leave it by saying this. I will also get the vaccine. I'm hesitant of vaccines. I don't love the idea of it. But I wouldn't want to be a part of a public service announcement just because that small 1% chance. I wouldn't want that on my shoulder. So maybe that's weak on my part.
No, it's not.
But that's the truth.
No.
You know,
that's right. It's the right position to
that's
take.
That's the truth. I would never want to be held responsible and lead people astray, but I will also get it when it is available.
That's the right position, but I do respect your right to take that position, Molly, and to not go out and make an affirmative statement about something about which you're unsure,
I know we got to go, but let me ask you a question just for clarification, Max. Why, even though you support somebody's right to take that position, but you don't agree with that position, why do you not agree with that position, Max?
Well, because let's say a vaccine, first of all, the link to autism is utter nonsense. It's just bunk. It's completely been debunked. Okay. So then it comes down to, like, what are we arguing? Are we arguing how effective it is? There is a chance, even if something's 95% effective, then lots and lots of people who get both vaccinations, you need two doses, are still going to get coronavirus. That's true. But then it prevented 95% of the time it prevented it. So I'm not quite sure what the objection is unless go ahead.
Well, my objection, and I know we got to go. What my objection would be to the PSA, Max, is that if something were to go awry, then I'm the example that didn't work. And as a result, it could dissuade people from doing what you and I believe they should do. In other words, like that slight minimal chance. Mm-hmm. There are millions of people who
have
could
a reaction
be
to it or something.
Yes. And I'm saying they could be affected by it because it might not have worked for me, but it worked for 1 million people. And I'm the example that they use to dissuade them from doing what they should do. You can think about it like that.
Was once upon a time polio,
we can continue
too.
It after.
And if we took that attitude, there'd still be polio. People got vaccinated.
That's fair. That's fair.
Hey, I'm Molly Karam, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-time chimney sweepers, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish, but you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com to sign up today. Claim based on the total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Thanks so much for listening to the First Take Pod. Have a fabulous day.
Hey, I'm Molly Karam, and thanks so much for listening to the First Take podcast. Shopping for Mother's Day is always a challenge because you wait until the last minute. But Macy's Gift Finder makes it incredibly fast and easy to find the right gift just in time for Mother's Day, whether you're shopping for your sister's first Mother's Day or your fashionista mom who loves to make a statement. Macy's Gift Finder has so many great gift ideas that you can easily pick out something special to celebrate them both. You can shop by price, anywhere from $25 and under to $100 and under. You can also sort by categories like fragrance, handbags, and more. Or gift lists, like for the mom who has everything. Pre-wrapped gifts or gifts for grandma. Find top brands like Studio Pro Model Beats headphones, Polaroid cameras, Samsung smart TVs. So what are you waiting for? Mother's Day's May 12th, and it'll be here before you know it. Macy's has the perfect gift guide to make picking something for mom easy this year. Head to Macy's.com/giftfinder today. That's Macy's.com/giftfinder. Thanks so much for listening to the pod and have a fabulous day. GOAT debate time. NFL.com recently listed its top five GOATs of all time. Tom Brady coming in at number one, MJ coming in at two, Wayne Gretzky three, Tiger four, and Serena Williams rounding out the top five. We now welcome in Lewis Riddick to the show. And Lewis, in case you missed it earlier, Max Kellerman, not a fan of this list. So if anyone's joining us at home, Max, can you re-educate us on your top five GOATs, please?
Well, first, this is a truly awful list with tons of recency and NFL bias in it. Tom Brady, number one. In order to be the GOAT of all GOATs, you have to usually be considered the best player in your sport. Tom Brady rarely was, in fact. There were years where Peyton Manning was considered better, Aaron Rodgers was considered better. He had some years where he was considered number one, but not like Michael Jordan, who is the answer, who for 10 straight years or 10 years was the best player in the world and also won the most and also never got to a seventh game and also put up the greatest numbers of all time, even in retrospect. Like Babe Ruth, who did play pre-integration, that is true. But no one ever in any top baseball league around the world, including the major leagues, Negro leagues, minor leagues, Japanese leagues, ever dominated both offense and defense. Babe Ruth was one of the all-time clutch pitchers in baseball, like Babe Ruth did, not Josh Gibson, not Satchel Paige, not anyone, Barry Bonds or anyone. No one did both. Muhammad Ali was not the best pound for pound of all time, but boxing stratifies according to weight. Muhammad Ali would have beaten the hell out of Sugar Ray Robinson. He's bigger than him. Tom Brady's not being compared to, you know, Doug Flutie was a better pound-for-pound quarterback, so let's demote Tom Brady, right? It's not fair to Ali. And then there's off the field of play impact. Ali's number one. That's the top three. And if you want to keep going, we can. Serena Williams hit the highest peak in the history of her sport and also has almost the most majors and almost the most time spent as number one. And number five, Tom Brady, who deserves to be in the top five. By the way, there are a lot of guys a lot of athletes I'm putting them ahead of there. Sometimes was the best player in the world, though not usually. And at 43, he just won his seventh Super Bowl. He's on the list, barely in the top five.
My top five, I got Ali at number one because I take off the court adversity and what you've had to overcome into consideration. You don't get to live on the court or field of play and just stay there all day, every day, and be insulated from the outside world in order to compete. You have to be exposed to it all, which means adversity, trials and tribulations, you know, just all of those things just get in the way. And for him to overcome what he overcame with the government coming after you, with white America coming after you, with you being stripped of the license to fight and being denied the opportunity to fight and defend your crown for three plus years, to come back to regain the heavyweight championship by going up against a guy in George Foreman that had literally had people scared for a boxer's life, whoever went into the ring against him. I put Ali right there. Obviously, MJ would be number two. I think Serena Williams would be number three because she's absolutely sensational and the greatest of all time at her respective sport, as far as I'm concerned, even though she's one shy of capturing Margaret Court's all-time singles Grand Slam titles of 24. Serena's at 23. And then I think about number four, I think about Bill Russell. And the only reason I put Bill Russell in there is not because of the 11 titles in 13 years, but it was too as a player's coach, not just a player. And also it was him working in Boston, working through the civil rights era, accomplishing what he accomplished with that level of adversity faced against him and what have you. I think about Bill Russell in that regard and what he had to endure and had to overcome, where he is still scarred to this very day because of what he was subjected to. And somehow, some way, he just continued to win championships. And then obviously I look at that. And then if we could talk about Tom Brady or Wayne Gretzky at number five, that's where I'm at with that list. my personal opinion. It will not include Babe Ruth because Babe Ruth did not have to compete against black players. And as a black man, there's no way in hell I'm putting Babe Ruth on my top five all-time list. You didn't go up against black players. And we all know when it comes to athletics, black folks got something to say about that in terms
although
of elite category.
Black players at the
you
time, I'm sure they'd be like Babe Ruth.
There you go.
Yeah.
You never went against them. So you ain't on my top five. No.
Yeah, you know what? I really like the discussion when it kind of goes off the court or off the playing field and you're really talking about impact. You're really talking about societal impact, global impact when you're talking about GOATs, because I just tweeted about that just the other day with my number one with Michael Jordan in terms of how, all right, obviously not only did he transform basketball, or rather the way we watch basketball and the way in which we look at basketball players, but I mean, he's just one of those guys who now continues to, now almost 20 years after he last played basketball, he continues to redefine what it means to be a sportsman and have an impact in so many different areas. Bill Russell, look, the longevity with which he was able to really just achieve at a high level 11 championships in 13 years, Stephen A., as you referred to, and the fact that he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom and he was a coach as well. I mean, and this is despite the fact that, look, I know people want to point to stats. He never averaged over 20 points per game in a season. Correct me if I'm wrong in terms of when he played, but his impact on the defensive end and just his championship pedigree. Serena Williams, I think we all sat and watched her last night, and the fact that she's just one away in terms of tying the record for major Grand Slam titles is just ridiculous. She's another one who, again, has impacted individuals globally in terms of what they believe they can achieve because of her dominance. Tiger Woods, look, I mean, there were commercials about people, about young minorities across the world, around the globe, saying, I am Tiger Woods. Well, why were they saying that? Because he really kind of opened the doors and made people see another avenue with which to succeed in a sport where maybe they didn't feel as though they could succeed. And that was because of his dominance, his sheer dominance, and the fact that he is still knocking on the door as far as all-time records, as far as major championships. That he, and who knows, maybe he eclipses it, maybe he doesn't. But just the fact that he's there, given everything that he has overcome, it's just fantastic and spectacular to me. And again, the global impact part of it. At number five, I have LeBron and Tom together at that point. Because look, I think with LeBron James, I've heard Kendrick Perkins talk about this numerous different times, about the fact that ever since this guy was in high school, since he was 16, 17 years old, people have kind of deemed him the chosen one, the king, the guy who had expectations put on him that were really just ridiculous in the stratosphere. And he has met those expectations time and time and time again, where people have, and he has had to, you know, bear the weight of being compared to people who are on this list, like Michael Jordan. And he has answered the bell time and time and time again, taking three different franchises to NBA championships, continues right now to pass the eye test, which I think a lot of this, you know, has to do with as well. When you watch LeBron James play, you aren't going to tell me that if you go back and you YouTube some of the greatest athletes of all time across all sports, that he is not one of the greatest athletes to ever walk the face of this planet. You just cannot deny that, on top of the fact that he is one. And then Tom Brady, look, himself, from a pure athletic standpoint, he's not one of the greatest athletes of all times. He's one of the greatest winners of all time. He's had the biggest impact in the greatest team sport of all time, no question about that. 7 Super Bowls, 10 appearances, that speaks for itself, the numerous records that he has and where he has come from. He wasn't the chosen one. He was a guy who wasn't even expected to maybe even make New England's roster as a rookie. He was the fifth quarterback on the roster. That's what I respect the most about Tom Brady, is where he's come from and what he has accomplished and how he continues to accomplish it in the greatest team sport that all of us have ever watched, you know, on TV or otherwise. I mean, that's what football is.
I respect your list based on your criteria. I would say that Tiger Woods has fewer majors than Nicklaus, also far fewer second and third place finishes than Nicklaus. But when you add your criteria, I respect it, except where's Muhammad Ali? If you're going to have that criteria, yeah, Ali's got to be on there.
You're right. You're right. And you know what? I struggled with it. I really did. Okay. And I don't want to be accused of recency bias, because I'm one of those people who considers myself to be a historian when it comes to sports. And Muhammad Ali is someone who I was very little when he was in his prime, or rather when he was nearing the end of his career. I was still a young boy, but I understand the impact that he has had on, you know, in the greater context of sports overall. So you're right. He probably should be on there.
And he should be number one if that's your criteria. I don't think there's anyone really close to him. But I want to say something else, guys, about Bill Russell. I respect Bill Russell if you're talking about the all-time winners, the whole thing. He and Tom Brady are sort of in the same category. But you know what? Yogi Berra won 10 World Series championships, was a three-time MVP, hit cleanup. Every pitcher that came to the Yankees improved because he called the games. No one calls him the GOAT correctly. Maybe he's the GOAT catcher, just like maybe Bill Russell's the GOAT center. But when we're talking about the GOAT of all GOATs, it ain't Bill Russell, it ain't Tom Brady, and it ain't Yogi Berra.
Well,
we're talking about Michael Jordan and that ilk. They were clearly just the best forever, and they won the most.
Max, first of all, I'm allergic to putting Bill Russell and Tom Brady in the same sentence because while Bill Russell had to endure such incredible, incredible adversity, particularly in the same locale, we all know what an angel Tom Brady has been treated like in that area. He's been deified in the whole Boston era, in the whole Boston area. Those are apples and oranges if ever there was one. Now, let me get to your point about Tiger Woods because I'm interested in both of y'all takes on this. Tiger Woods, obviously, as far as I'm concerned, was just a phenomenal, phenomenal talent. And you can call him to go to whatever. I'm not a golf aficionado. I didn't follow golf until Tiger Woods arrived because I never felt as a black man I was welcome to the sport, if I'm being totally candid about it. But I will tell you this. When I think about Tiger Woods, as much as I revere him because he was phenomenal, here's where he falls off that list to me. When adversity hit, where was he? I'm talking about it was self-inflicted. We understand what went on with him and his family and stuff like that and, you know, and the police and all of this other stuff. We got all of that and then the divorce and that's all his business. I'm not trying to get into that. What I'm saying is that as we look at our list, when we talk about Ali, when we talk about Jordan, when we talk about Serena, when we talk about Bill Russell, we talk about these folks and they're deified to some degree because when faced with adversity, they didn't wilt beneath the pressure or the microscope. They ascended. Now, that's not to say that Tiger Woods never came back and resurrected himself. He just won the Masters a couple of years ago. I get that. My point is that how many years have we looked at Tiger Woods? And in fairness to him, it wasn't just the adversity in his personal life. It was also injuries with the back and all of that stuff. I get it. But really, where the fall began immediately was when he had that situation years ago, back around 2008 or so, and the cops got involved, and he sat up there and looked like he was drugged for a conference where he was like, I am so sorry. And you know what? And his game was sorry for a long time thereafter. That's my point about Tiger Woods. The level of adversity others overcame when he was faced with that, he did not respond the same as those guys, which is why when we talk top five, it's not that he's not one of the greatest. It's not that he's not top 10. Tiger is special. We get all of that. When we talk about this particular list, guys showed tremendous intestinal resolve that, to me, Tiger Woods did not have, at least at one point.
Riddick, real quick, let me just say, I agree with you, Stephen A. He did win the Masters, though, very recently. And
and
I really do think the reason he fell off, we did a lot of armchair shrink or whatever you want to call it. People played amateur psychologist, but he had a bad back. I have a bad back. Trust me, you can't. When it's bad, you can't move. And he talked about that. When the back got better, he won the Masters, right? But I do agree with you. In terms of impact, that's right. When it got tough, where was Tiger for like 10 years? And on top of that, he's not in his own sport. There's a guy more accomplished than him. More majors, more second place finishes, more third place finishes. So I don't think any cultural impact he had in golf outweighs what you just said when he's not the Michael Jordan of golf. When, like Michael Jordan, 10 years, no one was close to him. That's a different thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think he belongs on the top five, in the top five, maybe in the top 10.
Well, look,
right, excuse me, guys. Can I get in here? Because I got some breaking news. And you're going to love this, Louis Riddick, being a guy who knows Philly so well. And Max, it's really Max's specialty, Carson Wentz. Breaking news here. Carson Wentz has been traded to the Indianapolis Colts. Here's the details as of right now. It's an exchange for a 2021 third round pick, a conditional 2022 second round pick that could turn into
a first. Max, what do you think of this? For a third and a second, he's going to the Colts.
The Colts badly overpaid. Badly. You should receive draft compensation for taking Carson Wentz, who I told everyone 2 years ago in the second half was not good. And then last year, everyone finally figured out, actually, yeah, he's not good. He's a reclamation project. Notice the only two teams interested were former teams with former coach connections, right? Reich and also DeFilippo in Chicago. When the Eagles were talking about multiple first-round picks, that was laughable. The fact that they now have a second and maybe it could be a first down the road, right now what it is, a third and a second, and that's too much to pay. And by the way, I don't like if you sense some kind of negative feeling toward Carson Wentz for me, he's very tough. I think he wants to be great, and he's extremely talented. But there was so much regression, and he had way too much power in the organization, in my opinion. And what I don't like, if you're sensing some kind of negativity, like whatever I've said about Tom Brady, it was personal, it's that I thought he was getting old. He showed me otherwise. In Carson Wentz's case, the way he handled the benching was awful. The fact that suddenly it would come out in the press the day of Jalen Hurts' pro debut as a starter, that, oh, if Carson Wentz is going to be a backup, he wants out. Like, to me, like, you really want that in your locker room? Carson Wentz, to me, they need to build him up from the ground up. And that includes the attitude and everything. No first-round pick in the deal. I still think they overpaid.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to debate that third-round pick, conditional second-round pick. I mean, basically what you're saying is that Carson Wentz should have been given away for a bag of cookies, okay? That's basically what you're saying. I mean, how dare anybody give any kind of compensation for him, how awful he has been? That's not how it works. When you have a trade, somebody gets something in return for somebody else's services. And when you think about Frank Reich being the head coach and the fact that he was the quarterback's coach and offensive coordinator for the Philadelphia Eagles the year they went to the Super Bowl, 13 of those games were with Carson Wentz as his quarterback, and they were 11-2 before Carson Wentz went down. And so I look at it from that perspective, and Frank Reich knows how to work with this particular quarterback. But there's something else that comes with it that I think we have to pay attention to. Pro Football Focus had the Colts ranked as like the 7th best offensive line in football. They had some injuries and what have you, and we know that, and that's why they tailed off from being even better than that, but they were still a top 10 offensive line in this league. Why should that be relevant? Carson Wentz was sacked 50 times last year. 5-0, 50 times. The Philadelphia Eagles gave up 65 sacks as a team. 65 sacks. The Indianapolis Colts gave up 19 with a stationary target as Phillip Rivers as their quarterback. 19 sacks. Think about that for a second here. So I'm Carson Wentz. Now, you could point to him holding the football a little bit too long, and it's really not about the offensive line. It was really about, Carson Wentz holding the football, not getting rid of the football quick enough, et cetera, et cetera. You could do that. Or you could look at it and say, T.Y. Hilton is there. They've got some other weapons in there. They got a decent running game with Mack and the crew there. And you got an offensive line with Frank Reich, a guy that he respects and listens to, coaching him. I think this is a good move for the Colts. I think they, believe it or not, I'm willing to go so far as to say they won this trade because of who he's going to. Not because of Wentz, but because of who he's going to and the support that he has around him. I think it's better than what he had in Philly, and I think it's a good move for the Colts to have made.
Look, I think this is the perfect price for Chris Ballard to have paid for Carson Wentz. You weren't going to get him for free. I disagree wholeheartedly that Carson Wentz is just really right now, just kind of trash that you need to just throw out the door. And look, I've heard you for a long time talk about Carson in this way, Max. And look,
Max,
I get
right?
it. I get where you're coming from and why you're coming at him this way in terms of how his play tailed off. I don't think that physically he is someone that cannot be, let's just say, rehabilitated from a physical standpoint. I think what's going on with Carson Wentz is strictly and totally, it's mental as far as how he handles being challenged, how he handles being competed against, how he handles adversity, how he handles expectations. There's no question about that. He has been fragile. He has been brittle, and he has not handled it very well in that way at all. And that has manifested itself into his play declining at such a rate that is really, it's unfathomable to me. It's one of those things I never just expected to happen. But I think the negative effect of drafting Jalen Hurts and having that kind of competition for him was something that Philadelphia severely, severely underestimated. And I'm not saying that they're wrong for it. I'm just saying they underestimated and Carson did not handle it very well. That being said, going to Indianapolis is the very, very best place for him to go. It really was the only place for him to go if he's to have any chance to really get his mind right, first of all, and then have the kind of supporting cast that he needs in order to reclaim his status as one of the better quarterbacks in the NFL. I don't think there was any other place that he could go in order to achieve that. Frank Reich understands what makes Carson tick, how he fell off, the kind of things he's going to need to do for him on a personal basis in order to get him to play at a high level, keep his confidence up. He does have a much better offensive philosophy and or system with which Carson will now be able to, you know, operate under. And I think right now, it's one of these situations where it's sink or swim for him. It's all or nothing now for him in Indianapolis, because if it doesn't work out there, I believe his career is over. It's
guys,
done. He will be out of the league very quickly.
Guys, hold on. Guys, real quickly, I just wanted to make sure I made a correction because I mentioned Marlon Mack. I mentioned Mack initially, but I meant Jonathan Taylor because I know he's the leading rusher for them this past year. But go ahead.
Yeah, Stephen A., I just want to say, I think the two of you, if I combine the points, hit on it. Indianapolis is clearly, clearly the best chance Carson Wentz has because, yeah, DeFilippo's in Chicago, but there's no O-line. And Stephen A., you hit the nail on the head in Indianapolis. Quentin Nelson was such a great draft pick, and everyone
Monster.
Knew he was going to be great. But and Lewis, you know, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but to my eyes,
best
he's one of the best interior offensive linemen I have ever seen. If someone said, like, name the best interior, I he's the first. I've never seen anything like that at the guard position. And the fact that Carson Wentz will be protected by that line and he has a coach there, it gives him a shot.
The number one thing Carson's going to need to do is rehab himself mentally, period. And Frank is the only person really who can help him do that at this point.
That's right.
If it doesn't work out here, I'm telling you, his
career
is going to be
when
done.
Frank was the OC, he had the best, he had the best QBR in the league. All right, Lewis, we got to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for the analysis. Breaking news into First Take on this Friday Eve. Carson Wentz has been traded from the Philadelphia Eagles. He is now an Indianapolis Colt gentleman. As we just discussed before the commercial break, Adam Schefter there in more with all the details for a third and a second round pick that could essentially become a first round pick. Stephen A., just give me your final reaction here right now to Carson as a Colt reuniting with his former coach, Frank Reich.
It's sad that it came to this in Philadelphia, but at the end of the day, it was the right move to make, and I think that the Colts ended up winning in this deal because of who Carson Wentz is joining. He could not have entered a more perfect situation for himself.
I co-sign that. The other thing is conditional. How does it turn into a first rounder? So the Colts have to be no good so the deal doesn't work out, and then the Eagles get a first round pick? I'm not sure, but if any first rounder is had for Carson Wentz, that's a bad overpayment.
Yeah, and obviously we'll have much more on this tomorrow, guys. And I keep mentioning this, but I find it so interesting. Adam Schefter said 18 quarterbacks could be on the move this offseason. So there's going to be a lot to cover and react to. Really interesting times in the National Football League. Carson Wentz is an Indianapolis Colt. Fellas, good times. I'll see you in the morning. Have a good day. Everybody, be careful out there in the snow out here on the East Coast.